Before we get going with today's episode, if you feel that the podcast has been giving you a sense of connection or has added value to your life, then why not consider giving us a tip via our Tipjar account? Just look into the episode description or on our website. Everything you donate or give us in terms of support goes straight back into the podcast and will help us keep everything advert-free. So yeah, thank you in advance for even just considering.
To propose a podcast in which lesbians from all over the world can listen to lesbian affairs, and that can include anything from flannel shirts to cats, cat litter, cat sitters, hot cat sitters, lesbian affairs itself, politics, radical lesbians, veganism, non-veganism, anything. Welcome to a lesbian affair.
I can see in the wine bottles. That looks like a good wine rack in the back.
Yeah, but do you know what? You know what? Those literally have been there like for about 2 years because I hardly drink these days. Bear with, I'll just go and get my drink.
Hello, hello. We're back for another episode. My name is Jess and I'm joined today by Elaine Chambers, who's the author of This Queer Angel, One Woman's Battle Against the Country She Served. And as a bit of a disclaimer there already, we're going to be talking about your story today, Elaine, if that's okay. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Very nice to be here.
It's nice to have you here. There's so much to talk about. How about we just start off with how you identify? It's fair to say you identify as a lesbian, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's I've kind of gone through stages with how it feels about identifying. In an absolutely ideal world, I would just love us to get to a point where we don't have to have any labels. Right. And I just tell you, you know, I'm Elaine and you just take me as you see me and make your own mind up as you get to know me. I'd love that. But yes, I identify as lesbian, or in my time, particularly when I was first coming out, I quite liked using the word dyke because I quite liked that idea of reclaiming and, you know, taking something that I'd maybe had shouted at me on the street and going, yeah, I am. Do you have a problem with that? I quite like that, you know, kind of reclaiming it and fighting back a wee bit. So I quite like dyke because I think it sounds quite strong and quite sort of up yours kind of attitude, a little bit aggressive maybe. Yeah, and then there's loads of labels. There's plenty that I really like. I mean, another one I really like, me being a daydreamer, always sort of wishing I'd been born in a different era and class and all of that sort of thing. I love the word sapphist, or being sapphic. I really like that.
Mm, that's a first. I think that's the first time we've actually had that label as a variety mentioned. I like that.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, I mean, I just like it very much. I kind of associate it with 1920s. And that's what I'm saying about being born in a different era and a different class, because I certainly wouldn't like to have been born in the same class that I was actually born in. Mm. 120 years ago. I'd have liked to have been born around about 1898, 1900.
That's very precise.
It is, into the money classes. And it's precise because I would have liked to have been in my 20s, in the 20s, and swanning around, you know, Natalie Barney and Romaine Brooks salons in Paris, or going off to Berlin and, you know, just looking like an extra from Cabaret and the Cabaret Tête-à-Tête or whatever. So, yeah, I've got this very romantic notion. So sapphist, yeah, it just sounds more romantic and a little bit of bohemian, appeals to me.
Yeah. But we're kind of scratching the surface in a sense, because you saying I'm a lesbian is hard fought for and comes with mm-hmm. a lot of heartbreak as well.
Yeah.
Let's start off with the army, shall we? According to what I've read, you were 19 when you decided to go there, but I think the seed was planted way earlier. You mentioned your grandmother that you refer to as nine.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it's very interesting, isn't it? You know, when you look back on your life with the wisdom of hindsight, and you recognize certain key moments, even if you kind of knew they were key at the time, when you really look at it, you can think, oh, my God, you know, I just hadn't realized how significant something was. And it's looking right back makes me understand that was actually a huge part of why I joined the army. And it was this program that I watched on the telly when I was 13. It was immensely powerful and important at the time I watched it, for sure. But it obviously, it really had kind of planted itself in the back of my mind, because, you know, in later years when I was looking to join the army, people said, why are you joining the army? You know, does your family have a military history? And there was no real military background in my family. And when I was a little kid, you know, I didn't play doctors and nurses and dressing up. I was very much a tomboy. You know, I was very nerdy. I was really, really nerdy. I used to climb trees. I used to run around a lot. I love my bike. I love my little pedal car. I had this, it's very un-PC. I had this little pedal car when I was a kid, and it was called the Safari car. I loved that pedal car, and I used to drive round and round and round like a nutcase until I was nearly too big. I'd have my knees up my nose virtually. I didn't want to give up my pedal car. So I was this very tomboy.
Elaine, we have something in common.
Oh, do we?
I didn't think that. Yes, because I grew up in a farmland type sort of scenery of a country in Germany, and everybody had pedal tractors.
Oh, how lovely.
I couldn't get a pedal tractor. I was given like this, like a toy pram. And I just turned that around and turned that into a Wild West wagon.
So you sort of made your, kind of like made your own go-kart sort of thing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, totally. I just turned it around, got a cuddly toy on the front, that was the horse. And then I was like, yay.
Oh, that sounds superb. Yeah, yeah.
There's something about tomboy toy reappropriation that is unifying.
Oh, totally. I used to love playing with little matchbox toy cars. I would sit in the garden on my own for hours just imagining things with these cars. I did have a doll when I was little, and then I had Action Men. So sorry, I've gone very off piste. I do tend to do this. Yeah, that you know, the thing that happened when I was 13, it was just one of the key moments watching this program. And I honestly don't know why they let me watch it, because as I say, I was 13, but I was, you know, this is back in what, the early 70s. When kids were kids, you know, I was very young and very immature, and I very much still a child. And yeah, it was just crazy. It went out 25th of February 1974, and it was on BBC Two. And there was an announcement before it went out, which was very unusual in those days, you know, the days of only three channels. And it was something like the controller of BBC Two warning viewers that, you know, there were some scenes that some people might find offensive or whatever. And I was like, very naive 13-year-old at 9 p.m. hadn't been sent to bed, and I was sitting in the front room with Mum and Nine, my Welsh grandmother, and we started watching this play. It was half an hour long. It was part of a series called Second City Firsts, and it was called Girl, and it was written by a guy called James Robson, and it was just four characters in it, that's all. We were watching it, and I was like, okay, what's this all about? And it was interesting. The language was really quite strong, you know, for then. It was quite sweary and quite aggressive. And it was four women who were in a Women's Royal Army Corps training barracks. The main stars was Alison Steadman, who everyone, you know, I'm sure knows, who's become sort of like, you know, a national treasure. And it was one of her earliest roles. And she was playing this character who had been an army recruit, but was about to leave and go back into Civvy Street in disgrace because she'd got pregnant. And then the main other character was Myra Francis, and she plays this full corporal. Her role is of kind of the serial seducer, basically, of innocent young recruits. And so we're watching this program, and it's a little bit, the language is a bit fruity, and it's a little bit, what's going on here? Anyway, next thing.
Oh, I like the word fruity.
Yeah, well, it really was. And then next thing, she was a sergeant or whatever. She was, let's say she was a sergeant, I can't remember. But anyway, she comes in and she gets rid of the corporal looking after Alison Steadman's character. And they start talking and reminiscing. And while they're talking and reminiscing, they do a flashback scene. Well, oh my God, I just went scarlet. I was just like, oh, because this flashback scene, they were in bed together and they clearly did not have any gym jams on, and they were kind of cuddling and they were laughing. And then it ended up with, you didn't see anything happening. Looking back, it was astounding. It was very openly acknowledging that this woman was a lesbian and not ashamed or embarrassed or about to hang herself, or, you know, that she was a lesbian and that was that. And that particular scene ends with them laughing and giggling, and one pulls the sheet over them both, and then it comes back to the present day. Well, by now, I was just like a blooming Belisha Beacon. I was blushing beetroot because it just shocked me so much, you know. And I was like, oh, my God. And of course, and then my mum was a very heterosexual woman, very sexual, but very heterosexual. And Nine, my grandmother, where they were both a bit like, you know, what's going on here sort of thing. Oh, dear. So I thought they're going to turn this program over. You know, they're going to switch it off. They're going to think it's unsuitable, or I'm going to be suddenly, yeah, I think you should go to bed. You know, you're up early for school tomorrow or whatever. Oh, no, it wasn't, was it? It was a Friday. But they stuck with it. So I thought, oh, okay. And on it went. And then you heard a bit more about what happened and how this poor girl had got pregnant and what happened. And then they start talking about various things. And it was amazing. It was the first time I'd ever in my life heard the word dyke. It's great. The sergeant asks this girl, Jackie, she said, yeah, why did you join the army anyway? And she said, well, I don't know, the adverts, I suppose. And then the sergeant, the lesbian, basically says, what, really, you know, join the women's army, you know, picture of a dyke in Lovett, you know, supervising, you know, getting a tank out of a bog or something. I couldn't believe it. And I was like watching this, didn't really understand what that was about. But then they started talking about music and they put on, unfortunately, didn't do the best version. I know you're a big fan of Dusty Springfield, as am I. They didn't put on Dusty's version, but they did put on, I think it was Dionne Warwick's, a good close second.
Yeah.
This Girl's in Love with You.
Oh, what a shame.
And they start, yeah, but they started dancing towards one another.
Oh, gosh.
And then they actually danced. These two women, it's on the telly, they're holding one another very tightly, slow dancing. One's in her civvies because she's going to leave. The other is in uniform and they're dancing around. They're talking and, you know, they say, are you going to miss me? She, oh, yes, I am. And then they kissed one another. And it was not Anna Friel and Brookside. That was the first ever lesbian kiss. And in fact, I think it might even have been the first homosexual kiss on British television. And I watched it when it went out. And not only did they kiss, but they kissed again. So they kissed twice. Very passionately, and I was again. I mean, I'm going red remembering it. All these donkeys you say to.
Your complexion is doing quite well, actually. It's not that bad.
Oh, thank you. It was honestly, it was so unbelievably revelatory for me. It just blew me away. And it, to be brutally honest, I found it very arousing and erotic, which again, I was such a nerdy kind of kiddie kid. That was a bit of a shock in itself. It was just like, oh, hello. It was all. It was massively important. And I knew, partly because of the way Mum and Nine were reacting, that I couldn't let them know that I was thinking, wow, you know, well, look at these two. What's happening? This is amazing. I couldn't do that. And I knew that instinctively, even though I was very naive and sort of, you know, kind of behind the times. So it was a massive, massive big deal. And I managed to watch it again donkeys years later. And I have a very poor recording of it in my phone. I had to kind of play it on my telly and try and film it, trying to hold my phone still to get a copy of it. Because when I watched it again, whatever it would have been, something like 40 years later, I was astounded to see how it hadn't lost any of its power to me. It was still, you know, quite often when you revisit stuff that felt seminally important at the time, and then you go back and you go, oh, really? What was all that fuss about? No, I could absolutely see and understand why it had mattered so much to me and why it was this background influence as to why I might wish to join the army in the hopes of being seduced by somebody like Myra Francis.
So, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful that you have that connection with this piece of BBC history. And maybe this is going to be an inciting incident if anybody's listening from the BBC to digitize this copy properly and to actually give it out. It's probably more needed than ever because our history is such a fleeting thing anyway. Even what we're doing right now is a piece of oral history, but who actually chronicles it properly? So it's really nice.
Yeah, true.
I also get what you mean with certain things just don't lose their potency. You mentioned Dusty Springfield. For me, listening to I Close My Eyes and Count to 10, I still have the same feeling like I did way back when I heard it for the first time, like an elevator back to the past.
Oh, yeah. Well, music in particular, isn't it? I mean, it's so powerful. You can hear a song or an artist and, you know, boom, you are back in a very precise moment, place with a person, whatever. It will take you right back. And you might not have thought about it for years, but you'll hear something and you're like, oh, wow.
So interestingly, you saw that film and you noticed that there was eroticism to it for yourself. And I think we don't talk about eroticism enough anymore. I think the word is never actually used these days, which is a bit of a shame. I think that there's space for that. Was there already a realization of I might be a lesbian too and I might, or was it more of a implicit thing?
No, certainly by that stage, by the time, I suppose that's why it hit home so strongly and was so resonant for me, was because at that point I had a huge crush on a school friend. I was at an all-girls grammar school and I did call it a crush and I thought of it as a crush and I did that even then because I knew I didn't want to be the kind of girl who had a crush on a girl, because there was already that negativity around and about. It wasn't massive, but it was there. And I remember certain things quite well. I mean, like there were a couple of girls in the year below us. I didn't really know them. I kind of knew them to look at. The school wasn't huge. There were about 600 pupils altogether. And I had a crush on a girl in the same year as me, but not in my form group. And these two girls that were in the year below us, who were reputedly an item, I'd heard a few friends in my class talking about them in a really negative, just hateful way, as if they were perverts and disgusting. And I remember at the time, and that would have been after I'd seen that program, and while I was having this huge crush on this friend of mine. And I just remember thinking, wow, you know, who are they harming? I think someone said something, they caught them once in the same cubicle in the girls' toilets or whatever, you know, and either caught them or seen them both come out of the loo together and had made the assumption of what they might have been doing in there. I don't know. But I just remember when people were talking about them, I just thought, God, you know, the malevolence that you're throwing at these girls that you don't really know. They must have been, say, 13 or 14, I'm guessing. What's your problem? You know, they're not hurting you. But the fact of hearing people talk in that way, and then also seeing it reflected generally in broader society, like on you know, in the media, in the red top papers, or occasionally on the news, or just generically, it's things you would hear sometimes, or even families talking about things sometimes. Just this acute awareness of, wow, you know, people really hate gay people. So I don't want to be one of those people, because I know people will hate me, and particularly people I really like or I really love, you know, like my own family or, you know, friends. And so it was very scary. But my naivety was, I didn't sort of think in very strongly sexual terms. I was really quite romantic. I used to read from when I was really, really young. You know, you read all the classic sort of fairy tale kind of things, you know, where the prince comes and kisses whomever and wakes her up and, you know, all the rest of it. And when I used to play games in school, in junior school, I always wanted to play the boy, because I knew that a boy got to kiss a girl. It's interesting, because I think nowadays maybe people, you know, might think, ah, you know, maybe she's trans because she wants to be a boy. And I went, no, I didn't want to be a boy, but I knew that boys were allowed to kiss girls. So that was my notion. If we played games, we always used to argue, and I used to pretend to put up a fight about, oh, why do I always have to play Don the pilot? Deep down, I liked playing Don the pilot. I didn't particularly, as a very young girl, think, oh, yeah, you know, I fancy my friend Jill. You know, it wasn't that, but it was just this knowing that a boy could kiss a girl. That sounds so naive.
No, not at all. I think what you're actually talking about is an experience that is unpronounced for many people very often. I had the same experience. I went a little bit further than you. I had a male name, actually. Yeah, it was a similar situation, but I also didn't want to be, particularly in puberty times, the woman that's objectified by straight men. Don't know if that makes sense. It was very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it does.
Because I was a tomboy. I was playing with them on the football field. We'd be tumbling about and stuff like that. And suddenly they were starting to kind of like gather interest around girls. And I'd be like, but I'm more like you guys. I find girls attractive. So
yes,
back off. And also let me fancy girls. And it took a while, because the gender non-conforming behavior kind of preceded my awakening to my sexuality. Uh-huh. And I think that was the tricky part, because once I realized, hang on, I can be a girl and like girls. I don't have to be a man to be in a relationship with a girl or kiss girls. That's when the penny dropped. And that was something that had to develop, that didn't happen overnight. And I was quite happy having a male name for a long time and being mistaken as a man for a while.
Yeah.
So I feel your experience seems to be similar there to mine in certain ways. Maybe I'm presumptuous.
No, not at all. It sounds like it, you know, and it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I you know, like you said about being taken for being a man. I mean, many, many times in my life, you know, people have called me sir. And even when I was a little girl, you know, I remember a couple of times when mum would say, oh, you know, can you go around the shops and get such a thing? I used to go around to the local shops. And, you know, sometimes being called Sonny, you know, all right, son or Sonny. And I'd be thinking, but I'm a girl, you know. It's weird, you know. And even into adulthood, and there would be times, it's very strange. I noticed it particularly, it was so into my 30s. And it used to happen to me a lot when I was living in France. I would go into a shop, and because I've got trousers on and a winter coat and fairly short hair, it's almost like people don't fully look at it. people. You know, they come in, and the amount of times I would go into somewhere, oh, bonjour, monsieur, and you'd be like, and I'd do a little bonjour, and then they see the earrings and maybe a necklace, and then they take another, oh, excuse me, madame. Yeah, short hair and trousers does not always make a bloke. You know, it's quite funny, really. People just see, they just see a basic kind of shape or identity, and they don't look any closer. And then when they do, they at least have a decency to be slightly mortified and usually apologize. But yeah, it's weird. Very odd.
Well, this is always this tension, right? In a way that regards sexuality or anything, between what you identify as from the inside, what your comfort zone is, and what the outside ascribes to you. And I think throughout the decades, the outside really kind of like dips from ideology to ideology and changes their labels. But I find for myself, it's fairly steady. It's quite the same. It doesn't really change that much. I'm quite lucky in that sense that I don't have to constantly reevaluate if I'm pleasing the outside world with the fact that I'm calling myself a lesbian, for example, right now. So to go back to where we were starting off. So you're 19, we've made a bit of a jump now. At 13, you're seeing that program. In between, we've got little girl crushes. I'm aware there was also a girl that you kind of were writing messages back and forth with. I think she was straight, right?
Yeah, that was my school friend. She was in my year, but not in my form. And I don't know what it was about her. It was really peculiar. You know, there was just, she had this massive effect on me whenever I saw her. I was just like, oh my God, I was like a lovesick puppy, you know. And I could spot her from miles away. Oh, there she is. You know, heart pounding and the hairs on the back of your neck prickling up. And like, oh, it was really strange because each form group had their own classroom. And then you would move around different classrooms for different subjects. And this particular time, her maths group had their maths lesson in my class. And she, oh, my God, you know, I came back in from break and there she was picking her books up off my desk. And I was just like, oh, my God, it's her. Oh, my God. And, yeah, it was really strange. You know, we'd sort of nod in a passing sort of, oh, hi, you know, whatever, and, you know. And then, yeah, and then she wrote a note on my desk. On the what a vandal, you know, the wooden lid of my school desk, and she wrote a message to me, and I was just like, oh my God, you know, as it was all, I thought at first I was like, who's bloody written on my desk, bloody cheek, what's this? And then I was like, oh my God, it's from her, you know. And I was quite a goody two shoes. Mostly a goody two shoes, and I my God, I couldn't believe it. So of course I wrote a message back. And then before you knew it, my desk was covered in this series of messages, you know, because she would write a little message to me all the time.
What sort of stuff was it? Was it?
It was.
Please tell me it wasn't her asking for your homework or something like that. That would be a little bit.
No, it wasn't that. I mean, here's the mad thing as well. I mean, oh, this is going to sound horribly weird and stalkery-ish, but it wasn't. It was just besotted. I actually can't remember most of it, genuinely, because it was inane piffle, I think. There was a lot of sort of minor bitchiness about teachers. There was quite a lot from her about her boyfriend, which was obviously rather disappointing.
Oh, no.
But I kind of didn't care. It was like she was communicating with me. It was like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, I got to know her a bit more because we would get the same bus home. And of course, if she ever sat on the bus next to me, I was just like in seventh heaven. I couldn't believe it. You know, I just adored her. I was just obsessed with it. It was ridiculous. Yeah, it was strange. So, and yeah, these messages went to and fro. And I actually, yeah, I copied them all out when we were leaving school. I kept staying behind after school and I copied them, you know, like the best forger you could ever meet. And I wrote everything in this little book to remember her by, because we were going off to different sixth form colleges. But I'm still in touch with her now, though, after many, many years of big gap between us all. Most of her form group and everything, they all kind of get together and they've all stayed in touch. And they meet up every year and have a spa day. And the last few years, they'd invited me to join them as a kind of honorary member of their form room. And she knows I have this crush on her now, but she didn't know then. She was absolutely clueless. And I asked her, can I use your real name in the book? I want to write about this. Do you mind? She said, let me see. I said, no, not at all. I'm actually really honoured. And then she actually said, which was really sweet, she said, I'm so sorry if I caused you any pain. She said, I didn't have a clue. I said, no, it wasn't pain. It was sort of an exquisite, like, oh. She's so lovely. It was very sappy, but it was quite sweet, I suppose. It was like a crush. It was truly like a crush, you know. I never wanted to do anything more than imagine kissing her. You know, I never went beyond that. I was very innocent really for a long time.
I think there is this weird, exquisite teenage sapphist scenario of a crush that's unrequited. I would argue that most sapphists have gone through that.
Yeah, probably.
I'm going to use that word more.
Oh, good.
So yeah, fast forward. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened when you were 19 and first got into the idea of applying for the army and then being in London?
Well, yeah, basically ended up going to sixth form college and did very badly there. And I always remember, I think it was in the second year of grammar school, and then saying to you, very important, the decisions you make now and the subjects you make now will affect your entire life and your career. And I remember at the time thinking, but I don't know what I want to do, and being really jealous of a few people I knew who did. And some of them were amazing. Some of them knew from like 11. I genuinely didn't have a Scooby-Doo. And I was just like, I just don't know. So I made the decision, and it was a fatefully wrong decision. I went for Spanish A-level, and I moved from one teacher who I adored at grammar school, who was just brilliant, to this guy that I just, we just did not get on. I didn't like him. I found him very lumpy and stolid and uninspiring, whereas, you know, Miss Thomas had been like brilliant. So it was just horrible. And I did very badly, and I didn't like it there because I hadn't wanted to leave grammar school, and I was just really a bit lost. And I just remember the most ridiculous so-called careers advice. And you go in and see this poor teacher who's supposedly the careers advisor, and they looked as bored as we were. You know, what do you want to do? I don't know. I've never really known. I'm quite good at languages. Okay, what about becoming an air hostess? So, you know, because then you'll travel and you'll meet people, and then you can speak their languages. And I thought, oh, yeah, all right. It really was like that. I wrote a letter to British Airways, you know, I'd like to come train to be an air stewardess because I look so girly and feminine and I wear so much makeup and, you know, I just look exactly
well,
like...
Well, uniform did play a part in your life, to be fair.
Yeah, that's true. And then I got this very charming letter back saying, thank you so much, but you'll need to apply again when you're 21. So I went back to the careers teacher, who then said, well, why don't you work in a hotel? Because they have lots of foreign guests and you can, you know, get some customer service skills while you're waiting to be 21.
Keeps getting better.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's unbelievable. I look back seriously and I just think, good grief. And I actually do get very cross because it never, ever seemed to occur to anybody, my teachers, my family or anyone, that with the right guidance and pushed in the right direction. I mean, I'm no Einstein, but I'm quite an intelligent person. And it never, ever came into my orbit, would you like to try to go to university?
Wow.
And I've always regretted that, always regretted that. And so I kind of just gave in and just imagined I have to go and find a job when I'm 18. That was kind of expected almost. I applied to a hotel company. I got offered this job. The title was a very unwieldy title of receptionist, telephonist, cashier, and got on with my job and hardly ever got the chance to speak French or Spanish, but occasionally tried. I liked the job and it was fine, but it was real dead man's shoes stuff. You know, you were never going to get a promotion. And it was okay. I quite enjoyed it. But I had another crush, quelle surprise, on one of my workmates. It got ridiculous. All the time this was going on, though, I mean, incidentally, I was still seeing men or boys or, you know, trying to be straight or trying to convince myself that I was, you know, maybe bisexual, or that these were just crushes and they were phases and they were going to end because, you know, I really wanted them to end. But it wasn't that I wanted to be straight. Again, with the wisdom of hindsight, I never wanted to be straight. I couldn't be straight because I'm not. You know, I'm absolutely convinced I was born this way and I don't have a choice. The choice I have is whether I accept myself or not, which came a fair bit later.
That's an important point you're making there. I like that sentence. Yeah.
I think, and I think what it is, it's not that I wanted to be straight, but it's I wanted not to be gay, if that makes sense, because I knew so many people hate gay people or did at those times. And well, still do, don't they? Some of them. But
yeah, no, it does make sense.
Yeah. So I couldn't really go anywhere with this job. It was okay, but there was no real future or anything. And I just had this sudden image about the army. And the other reason I had the image about the army was because I knew that you could get a job as a driver and be properly trained to drive. And they do these really intensive courses to get you qualified if you, you know, if you're lucky enough to get on them. And I absolutely love driving, and I do to this day. So yeah, so that's why I thought, well, maybe I'll apply to the army and I'll apply to train to be a driver. And off I went and went to the recruiting depot in Whitehall and said, you know, I want to be a driver, please. And he just looked at me and he said, everybody who applies for the WRAC wants to be a driver. There's a 2-year waiting list and you've got A-levels. So why don't you join the QAs instead? And I said, what's the QAs? And he gave me the brochure to take away and have a look at. And I took it away and read about the QAs, which was Queen Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps. And that's when I thought, okay, nursing. Yeah, I wonder. Which was my family's reaction was hilarious. And that kind of pushed me on even more, because the minute I told them, they were like, oh, what? You in the army? Are you mad? You know, your room's a pigsty. You hate getting up early. Nursing? And they said, and this is a very common misconception, although I think there are plenty of vocational nurses out there. But, you know, the belief is that to be a nurse, it's something that, you know, you're born into and you must, because you're so caring and compassionate and it's a vocation. I had no choice but to be a nurse because I want to care for people. No, there are many vocational nurses, but not all of us. And I did literally, you know, I just fell into it. It was just like, yeah, I could give that a go. So I applied, got through the, you know, the process, which was quite an arduous process to be accepted. And I got accepted. And then ironically, there was still nearly a 2-year waiting list to get into the QAs as well as the WRAC.
They could have told you that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a bit of and it was interesting because by then I'd left the hotel in London. I got a job at the post office working as a counter clerk. And I absolutely loved it. So I was actually having a rather nice life. And the manager of the post office that I was working at in Stanmore was saying, you know, you're doing really well. You could end up a postmistress and, you know, be in charge of your own office. And I was like, ooh, you know. And so as the date came closer to actually go and sign the dotted line and enlist for 22 years. Wow. So that was the original engagement that I would have been
That's
on.
That's a commitment. 22 years.
Yeah, but you can leave, but you had to give just a short period of notice, 18 months, if you want to leave, and that's after you've completed your training and paid them 18 months back. Or the only other way in those days that you could leave early would be on marriage, pregnancy, or as I was to later find out, being lesbian.
God.
So
you had this junction between becoming a postmistress, which is an interesting title these days. That sounds very interesting. Also choosing to be enlisted and really going for it. You'd waited those 2 years for the QA. What made you do it in the end?
I think it was a mix of things, to be honest. It's very interesting because sometimes people make an assumption about you if you've been in the army or the forces. And I understand that how those assumptions could be made, but I think sometimes people will think, oh, someone who's been in the army has got to be almost neo-fascistic right wing or very overly patriotic, you know, England forever, ooh, England, and queen and country and all that kind of nonsense. Absolutely could not have been further from the truth for me. But it was a combination, I think, of partly there was a little bit of me, I think, when my family were like, oh, my God, you in the army, that will never work. It was almost like I wanted to do it to prove I could. I can get up early. I can iron a uniform. I can learn to run, you know, and pass my basic fitness tests. And, you know, why couldn't I learn to be a nurse, you know? And it was almost a little bit of a defiance. So there was an element of that. Back in those days, there were a lot of fantastic postings for nursing staff all around the world. So that was very, very appealing. The other thing that's very appealing is it's the kind of lifestyle, if you can adapt to it, you've nothing to worry about because you're going to be given your accommodation, your uniform, your food. The whole of the 3 years training was laid out right from the word go. I knew exactly what specialism I'd be doing when and where I would be posted to and when I would need to sit this exam and that exam. Everything was very, as you would expect, it's very kind of structured, very orderly, quite good money, you know, at the time, not bad. And of course, then you've got all the stuff that comes with it that would cost you a fortune if you were doing it on your own. So, you know, all your free healthcare, dental care, sporting facilities, options for travel. Like I say, they even offered this 1 week intensive driving course that could get you qualified and give you your driver's license like that, you know.
So education was a huge part of it in a sense.
Yeah, I think so. And I understood that the QAs had a brilliant reputation and that, you know, if I didn't like it and left in the future, I could join the army and get a training and a qualification that was equally recognised in civilian life. And so that is completely transferable skill. I suppose it was a gamble. You know, it was a big gamble.
It is fascinating. I'm wondering how much has changed. Because in a sense, just for the pacifists that are listening, dear pacifist lesbians, we're not advertising the army here.
I'm a pacifist.
There we go.
No, I am.
Yeah. Okay. We need to actually own in on that a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. It's complicated because people think, how could you possibly have been in the army and be a pacifist? But it's true.
Well, I'm intrigued. I think, if anything, I think it is possible to be that, but it plays into, again, these stereotypes and these entrenched positions and at times also politicized positions around what it means to be in the army and to wear the uniform. Yeah. And I think that has changed over the years in many ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're interested in your story in this podcast. So we're going to be talking about the army a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, there is a picture of you in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's called Sister Chambers.
Oh, yeah, with the veil kite thing. Yes.
Could you just describe?
Oh, yeah, it's the most ridiculous uniform. I mean, nowadays, I'm sure most people know, especially thanks to this wretched pandemic, you know, we see nothing but nurses and doctors on telly all the time. And mostly now people are in the old theatre scrubs. You know, I liken them to pyjamas. Very practical, very comfortable. Take them off, somebody cleans them before you put a new one on. No, in our day, it's utterly ridiculous. Yeah, the sister's uniform. Oh my goodness, what a blooming nightmare that thing was. Well, from the top down, so you have a veil on your head. We used to call it the kite because it is a kind of diamond-shaped kite thing. And it was an absolute nightmare to make. And nowadays, you would never get away with it on numerous levels, but primarily infection control, because obviously everything nowadays is it's disposable, which in it, I'm not entirely happy with everything being disposable because of where does all the waste and the rubbish go? Big problem.
Yeah.
We had the hats and we used to wear our belts with our buckle, you know, because now they'd be, you can't do that. You know, all the dirt will gather in your buckle and it's horrible, ugh, you know, but it looked great and you'd worked 3 years to get it and it meant something because it was a symbol. But the hats, when you were issued your uniform, you were only given three of them. So you would have one being washed, one being set and ready to be made, and then the one you're actually wearing on your head. And it's made up of a metre square of Irish linen. Now, you wash your Irish linen and you wash it in dip starch. You then put it onto a great big board in a drying room, the full square metre. And when it's dried, you peel it off the board. And then you origami it into submission and you use a steam iron and you try to create this strange creation that sticks out at very pointy angles from the side of your head. It's attached to the top of your scalp with numerous white hair grips. And it used to, actually, some people could not wear it because it made them bald. It was so heavy. But the other thing with the wretched thing, there are two things I used to tell people, and this is true. If you went out of the hospital to walk down to the officer's mess with this thing on a windy day, you could take off like a bloody hang glider because it would just lift up behind the back of your head and it would be like this and you'd be walking trying to hold the damn thing down and it would... But the other thing, it was very, very dangerous, is in those days, if you were doing the drug round, so you'd be pushing the trolley around to your patients to give them their drugs and you're the sister with these two very sharp, pointy dip starch things sticking out the side of your head, you could have taken a student nurse's eye out if you turned around too fast. What did you say? Oh, sorry. Bing. Awful. Completely impractical. And you'd get the like the resuscitation sisters, you know, whenever their bleep would go off because there's been a cardiac arrest, you know, so you get what's called the crash bleep. If they were working in intensive care or wherever and their crash beep would go off, the first thing they would do is take the bloody kite off and just throw it to the side because there's no way you can rush off and be doing CPR on people with that monstrosity on your head. And it's utterly ridiculous.
It does look like something out of Handmaid's Tale. I'm not sure if people have seen it, yeah. But it looks like this.
Yeah, I don't know if they use them now anymore, you know, maybe on a ceremonial basis, but I certainly, it was a dress. And again, utterly impractical. So you would have you'd dress, tights, leather shoes that were quite heavy, you know, for practicality, for manual handling when you're trying to move immobile patients, turn people. Not at all practical. I mean, you looked smart. It looked quite smart, I think, but no, it was not practical.
I'd be terrified. I'm just trying to envisage coming out of a coma and seeing sort of the kite. I think it's quite a scary thing, but then I might be biased. The thing that I find fascinating, though, is that women's clothing always tends to be very impractical when it comes to uniforms. I mean, were there male nurses?
Yes, there were. Yeah, yeah. We had a guy.
Did they wear the kite?
No. And that, again, there's the irony as well, because we had a guy in our group. His student uniform, we were all in these dresses. He had, they were like white trousers and a white kind of tunic top, because we used to say he looked like a dentist or an ice cream salesman. They still have huge problems. They're in the military now. You know, there's a big campaign going on. Colonel Diane Allen, who served in the army for a very long time, she's sort of gathering lots and lots of evidence of some of the most dreadful stuff that's gone on for women in the military and the way that women get treated, you know, and problems with sexual military trauma and the way, you know, underreporting of things and violence against women. But also, you know, she was amongst the first female officers to go through Sandhurst, and they just didn't have the right size kit, uniform, boots for women. There was no facility really made for women. And they're getting there, but there's still a lot of problems for women joining the military. I mean, I feel I was very lucky doing the nursing, because it was a little different, I think. I think had I gone into the Women's Royal Army Corps, as I'd originally intended as a driver, I think I might have found that really quite different. But I think learning to nurse and get the civilian equivalent qualification was a good thing, I think.
This is really interesting. I think there are so many elements and variables that as an outsider you don't consider. So, and I know that is a huge chunk of story that we're steering towards that I really want to talk about, mm-hmm. as well, which is to do with how the army in many ways let you down. But let's go back to the idea of pacifism for a second. I was just joking there, in the sense I was thinking, you know, all the vegan pacifist lesbians, please don't worry, we're not sponsored by the army. Quite the opposite, you will find in a minute. But when you say you're a pacifist, I'm intrigued. What kind of informs that for you?
If ever I say this to people, they'll think either I'm being utterly glib or facetious or taking the mickey. You know, how can I explain this well without anyone listening thinking this girl is a lunatic, or she, you know, she thinks she can have the best of both worlds kind of thing.
How about you don't give a shit?
Yeah, so I'm like, well, I do, though. This is the, I do. My reasons for joining the military had absolutely nothing to do with patriotism, even thinking about defence or aggression or wars. You know, my reasons, as I say, were utterly informed by that programme. But I had this notion, and then in later years from talking to other people, that there might be quite a few gay women in the military, and there were. For me, it was more to do with me being gay and where could I find other like-minded women, you know, in an environment that would be, you know, and this is going to sound ironic, too safe, but I honestly thought it was going to be safe. They give you a great big contract, and it's a big piece of paper. It's four sides of A4. It's a very small font. Yeah, I read all the way through it numerous times, particularly after I was made to go, to try and understand stuff. Because people say, well, why did you join the army? You must have known you weren't allowed to be a lesbian in the army. It must have been in your contract. Actually, it wasn't. There's no mention at all about lesbianism or homosexuality. Then there was later, partly because of me and things I did, but when I joined up, there was nothing about lesbianism in that contract. So I had nothing telling me that I could not be a lesbian or be involved with a woman, you know, in my private off-duty time. There was nothing in there at all. So I actually just thought it could be an interesting, good place for me to go and to meet other women, maybe. That was part of it. I'm not saying I was joining up in the hopes of sort of dating. It wasn't that, but I had a feeling it was a safe environment, possibly. You know, people say, well, why would you, you know, you join the military and say you're a pacifist? I absolutely, genuinely, I believe in nuclear disarmament. I believe we know wars don't work. We know this. How many millennia do we have to keep bloody fighting each other? Nobody wins in war. The winners don't win, the losers don't. Nobody wins. And, you know, when I say I'm a pacifist, I mean it entirely in that way that, you know, war is absolutely ridiculous. It solves nothing. And I know it sounds ludicrous to say, having been in the army and served Queen and Country, that I am a pacifist, but I am. War is ridiculous and awful. But until you've got enough of the world's most deranged despots under control, there has to be some form of military presence because of the threats. And it is that horribly difficult argument, isn't it, of how much is a military force there to attack or to defend? And that's the difficulty, isn't it? And whatever you're doing, whether you're attacking or defending, someone is going to get hurt. It's difficult.
I have deep respect for people who work in the military based on the fact that it's not actually currently a respected job. It's a really, really scrutinized job. And yet it takes a lot of hard work and courage and bravery. And you're also exposed to the whims of the decisions of people who might sometimes not be entirely, politically speaking, just well-minded or well-meaning with certain decisions. Mm. So it's difficult.
Oh, absolutely.
And also, yeah. I guess the thing with pacifism, and we could go really philosophize about that, is can it ever be achieved? Will we ever have a world that is 100% at peace? And I think the answer probably is no.
Sadly.
Call me a pessimist.
No.
But I don't think society is perfectible.
No, I totally agree. I don't think you're being a pessimist. I think you're sadly being a realist. You know, for all of the millions and billions of us that are good and kind and just want a decent world and a decent planet, we'd like to treat everyone nicely and be treated nicely and respected and respectful, there are plenty more that are willing to step all over everybody to get what they want, who are greedy and short-sighted. And unfortunately, you know, those kind of people are always going to have the hangers-on and acolytes that are out there for the temporary grabs that they can get while that person is in power. It would be really nice to have a concerted effort of not wanting to take each other's borders and countries and people, and to actually work together, because the planet is screwed anyway because of, you know, it's going with climate change and nobody's really working together to sort it. And I don't know what the answer is, apart from just trying to kind of live your own best life, you know, as best you can, really.
Yeah. Well, let's just say it this way. I'd feel safer. And I found this, at least when I first came here, to be an extremely welcoming and tolerant country. I could live my gayness here. And I will never forget that. And I'm always grateful for that experience of tolerance, which I didn't have in my country. At least not in the area I grew up in. And I don't like politics. They're really messy. And in many ways, I feel politically homeless.
Don't get me started. Politics.
I think I'd feel safe knowing that somebody like you is in the army who calls themselves a pacifist. I think that's a great idea, to have more people serving the army who actually have that aspiration. It doesn't mean that it's perfectible or ever comes true, but it's a nice value system to have. So, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. You know, and I think certainly most of the people I did my nurse training with, we were all joining for sort of similar reasons. It links very nicely to something you just said, actually, a couple of minutes ago. It's no secret to everybody who knows me. I absolutely loathe and detest Margaret Thatcher and Tory politics, particularly of the 80s. And, you know, that is the difficulty when you do join the military, and that they're hoping to change some of those things now to allow military personnel to actually belong to some form of equivalent to a trade union, and to be able to have some certain rights that they so far haven't really had. And that's where, you know, exactly what you're saying, it's difficult. If you've signed up, so you have to do what you're told. But sometimes you are being told to do dubious things. I mean, obviously, the natural most recent thing you can think of, obviously, is Blair hanging on Bush's coattails. And, you know, a friend of mine lost her life because she went back. She was my senior nurse tutor, and she later became a friend after I'd left the army. And she went, and I said to her, why are you going? You've served your time. Look at what you've done. You've trained hundreds, maybe thousands of us. You've done your bit for the military. Why would you want to put your life at risk and go? And she just said, Elaine, precisely because I've spent all those years teaching people how to be good army nurses, to nurse in a war zone, to look after our injured and the enemy injured in a war zone. And I want to do this because this is what I've been teaching people to do on paper or on acetates. But I want to go and do it. And she went out and did it. And she got Gulf War syndrome, numerous illnesses, and was dead a few years later at the age of 50. But yeah, shocking. Just shocking.
It is shocking. And I was just reminded of something. I remember going out and seeing the same person a couple of times in a club, in a basement bar, as lesbian bars tend to be organized as.
Yeah.
She had a shaved head and was in crutches and seemed to be in pain, but she was always still partying and clubbing. And I remember one day we just had a conversation and it turned out that she was, I think she must have been 20 at the time, so very young. Mm. And she had been to Iraq in the army, and she had come back with these injuries, these lasting things, chronic pain condition that wouldn't go away. And she was declared disabled. And I could see the hardship that she faced so early in her life. And I felt so deeply for her because I was thinking, goodness me, you're so young. You've got a whole life ahead of you. And it's kind of already kind of had this huge, whatever it was, it must have been life changing. And I was thinking, there is something to the army that is very appealing to usually working class people, women sometimes as well, who are deprived of a certain system of education, encouragement or whatever. And I could see that in her to a degree. I could see that young person that really wanted to strive and make something of herself. Like she seemed, even just in that basement bar, the fact that she was clubbing and stuff, she was a doer. She was not going to just sit on her challenges.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. And this inconsistency between duty of care and I think all over the world, how veterans are treated is a marker for the moral code of the country, I think, sometimes. But I really want to hear... Obviously, there's a crucial part to your story that we've created a bit of a cliffhanger now. You rose up the ranks within the army. We're still at that point where you said you were a student nurse, and then eventually you became an officer with a kite hat. Eventually, you were a lieutenant.
What happens is, so when I joined up, I was a student nurse. So you obviously got running in tandem. You've got your work grade, so student nurse, and then your military rank, so private, because that always made us laugh because it meant that my name sounded like the West Wing of a rather gorgeous house, you know. I'm retiring to my private chambers. So student nurse, 3 years training, qualify. Staff nurse, still a private. 15 months after qualifying as a staff nurse, I then apply for a commission. Get a commission, so then you leap up the ranks from private to lieutenant in one go. So you're jumping a lot. So you've gone 8 rank jump, boof, overnight. It's a big change. But in terms of nursing, you're a junior sister. So you're normally second in charge of a ward after a captain who would be like the senior sister. And then you're due your captaincy automatically at a certain point. And it's calculated from when you qualified as a registered general nurse or staff nurse. So I knew I would become a captain the 23rd of July, 1988.
1 year after the year that stuff went really difficult for you.
Yeah. Just a few months after I left. Terrible. So there I am. So I'm a lieutenant and I'm a junior sister, which is great. And I was only 15 months post-registration, so I was doing very well. And then I was posted back to Germany, but this time to Hanover. Yeah, the first few months were brilliant. I liked being an officer. I was good at it. Although in some ways, ostensibly, it was quite scary because it was Cold War years. There was that realization that it wouldn't matter if our squaddies or our equipment might be superior to Russian or East German conscripted squaddies and equipment. The sheer weight of numbers would have outgunned us in next to no time because, and at the time, so I'm jumping around a wee bit, I was still trying to be straight, even though by then I'd finally had a relationship, well, not a relationship, but an involvement with a woman at last. Ta-da!
That's insane. I'm just realizing when you were saying you were in the midst of the Cold War and that sort of tension of, are we going to go to war? Is there going to be an escalation? And I realized that my family would have been on the other side at that time. That's roughly the time when my uncle would have had to go through his horror in the military. So it's amazing to actually talk about it from these angles.
Yeah, so imagine both sides of this, you know, divide.
Both in Germany.
Probably, both terrified of one another. I mean, because I did 18 months in Rintel near Hamel.
Yeah.
And then the time I was in Hanover. But yeah, it was great. You know, I loved it. I was a good officer. I was a good nurse. I used to be fit and 2 stone lighter. So I was the unit sports officer. I was running. I was fit and healthy. And it was a good time. It was a good time to be out there. Our social life was just phenomenal. It was so good.
Yeah.
And yeah, everything was going great until it wasn't.
So let's go there for a second. How shall we start? Shall we introduce somebody by the name of Mel or?
Okay. Oh God, it was so stupid. It was so silly. I mean, everything that happened was off duty mutually consensual, behind closed doors, and nobody other than the two people involved knew anything about it.
How did you get to know each other? Like
she was another nursing sister.
Yeah.
Basically, I was living in the officer's mess. And so the officer's mess, it's just your accommodations. There's an accommodation block set very close to the hospital, in the grounds of the hospital in Hanover. And you basically, what you're given is you have a room with a sink in it. And then there are like shared washroom, shower blocks, you know, those kind of things. And then downstairs are what's all the public rooms. So that's where all the functions take place, where the bar is, where you the restaurant is, where you get your meals. And so you live in this mess. Now, this mess was what's called a mixed mess. So it was mainly QAs, sisters, and then, but there were some men from some other regiments that also lived in the mess. So it was a mixed mess. It was a strange little place. So the main women that were in this mess were other QAs like myself, but most of them were what are called direct entrant. And so that means, so I trained in the army and then become an officer and come up through the ranks. And my intention was to stay for many, many years and make a full career of it until I was 55. That was my eventual plan. Most of the other nursing sisters and QAs are NHS direct entrant commissioned officers that come in for 2 years because they just want the experience, the vast majority. Some will stay, some will convert to a regular commission and stay. So most of these other nurses are not army experienced. They come in, do a few weeks training, do their nursing as officers, and then go away again. That's important.
Yeah.
So this person, it's so stupid. We'd all gone out. There'd been a big night in the mess, and I was blooming furious because I'd been made duty officer again, and it was Friday night. And there were two big do's on in the mess, you know, Italian pasta night and German night or something. And everyone's getting all very drunk and having a great time. And then they're, we're all going off down nightclubbing. You know, are you coming with us, Elaine? I said, no, I'm bloody duty officer again. And they went, what? You were at 2 days. I said, yeah, I know. Somebody don't like me, do they? Anyway, someone overheard me who was on an early the next day. So she just said to me, give me the keys, Elaine. I'll do it for you. Now, that was a bit naughty. We shouldn't have done that, but we did. And it used to happen all the time. We all go off after a few wines in friends' rooms. And we went for a lovely meal and we went to a Turkish restaurant. And then we went to this disco because it was the era of discos. And it was very, very strange because I got talking to this guy that most people couldn't stand. He was a bit of a creep. I don't know if it was the infamous beer goggles or whatever, but we got talking and I saw a different side to him. And he was actually quite interesting when he kind of stopped showing off. And we ended up snogging because we were doing this like staring contest, you know, under the influence of beer.
You got the dopamine going. You looked into each other's eyes.
We did. It was ridiculous. Anyway, so I ended up snogging this guy. And it was quite pleasant, you know, worst things to do with your life, but, you know, not the best thing either. But
when in Hanover.
Absolutely. So then we all go back. And as we're getting back, I thought, oh, my God, you know, he wants me to come to his room. I don't want to go to his room. Oh, crikey, what am I going to do? So I ran off. I ran into the mess and I ran upstairs and I'm like watching down from two floors up and I could hear them, his friends. Oh, she's blown you out, old boy. Oh, what a shame. He's off he went. That was that. I came back down and of course I'd had such a great night and I was buzzing and excited, you know, because we'd be dancing, we'd have a few drinks, lovely meals. And I was just wide awake. So when I walked past Mel's room, the light was on under her door. So I just tapped very gently on the door because I thought, I wonder if, you know, she'll want a nightcap or something because we'd had a great night. So I knocked on the door and then there's this little, who is it sort of thing, very quietly. And I said, it's Elaine. I said, sorry, you know, I'm just wide awake. And I heard her moving and just a minute. And then I unlocked the door. Wait a minute, come in now. And I went in and the room was all very sort of subtly lit, pink and romantic-y, bordello-y look to it. Very strange. And
we're talking about an atmosphere. Were there candles?
There weren't candles, but there was an atmosphere and she was in bed. And so I said, as I came through the door and saw she, you know, obviously walked back and got into bed. I said, oh, God, I said, I'm so sorry. I said, look, I'll go to bed. And she said, no, it's all right. She said, I'm wide awake. She said, and anyway, I want to know, where did you get to? So she's like teasing me like that, you know. I said, oh, yeah, yes. I said, I had to hide. I said, you know, and she said, why did you hide? She said, we couldn't believe it when we saw you two, you know, playing tonsil hockey. I said, oh my God, honestly, I don't know why I did that. You know, hey, no harm done sort of thing. And she said, well, where did you go? And I said, well, I just had this feeling, you know, that he wanted me to come back to his room. And I knew what he was hoping for. And it's just, you know, no way. I just didn't want to do that if he was going to ask me to spend the night. And I didn't want to upset him. And that's when, and then she said, and what would you say if I asked you to spend the night?
Wow. Very forward.
Wow is right. Wow is right, Jess. I honestly, I was so shocked. And I was just like, it came from nowhere. It was, I swear to you, it was utterly, utterly unforeseen, unexpected. I just, it blew me away on every level. And I was just like, in fact, excuse, I am going to swear now. Inside, I was like, what the fuck? Did I just hear her right? You know, I almost thought, you know, am I that pissed? Did I hear her say, did she say, what? And she was just like looking at me, and there was this electric tension between us, by the way. This was really weird. She was in the bed and I was like by her bedside dressing table on the floor. And I was just kind of looking at her thinking, oh my gosh. And I was like looking, I did hear that right. And I was, as I was looking at her, it was really strange because I'd never fancied her. She was never on my radar as, you know, a crush or anything. I liked her. She was a nice person. She wasn't what I'd call a close friend, but she was part of my kind of social circle of friends, if you like. And I remember as I was looking at her and she's kind of just smiling at me with this really cheeky smile. And I remember thinking, okay, why not? That sounds dreadful, doesn't it? But it was because I'd only ever had one brief involvement before. So I said, I think I'd say yes. And it was very smiley and laughy, you know, between both of us. There was just this strange, smiley, nutty little energy. And I sort of said,
so it's like coquettish and flirtatious.
Yeah, sense, yeah, right? Absolutely. You know, and I said, well, I think I might say yes. And
well, she then offered.
Yeah, she did offer. She initiated it. She offered. And then she said, get your kit off then. And lifted the quilt cover up.
Wow, part two. That is very...
Yeah. And so I did. And, you know...
Decisive.
Yeah. And, you know, we spent the night together. It wasn't great, but it was fun and nice and, you know, everything else.
It's the thing with one-night stands.
Yes, completely, completely. And when I woke up in the morning, it was just awful because although it hadn't been amazing in terms of sex as such, it'd been enjoyable and you know, I felt right and comfortable. I didn't have an issue with it. But I kind of woke up thinking, wow, you know, this is amazing. You know, I had no idea. And I liked her. You know, she's a nice person. And of course, you know, she comes around and she's got a cup of coffee for me because I was very hungover, as was she. Yeah, you know, she kissed me on my shoulder, said good morning and all smiley and everything. And then she gave me this whole sort of spiel about, I know you wouldn't think so, you know, from the way I was acting last night and, you know, the things I was saying and I really enjoyed it and I've had a great night, but it's not really for me. And I thought, oh God, oh my God. I was just mortified. I was actually so glad because in those days, I'm a spectacles wearer now and I have been since I was 5, but in those years I used to sometimes wear contact lenses. But when I don't have my specs on or my contact lenses out, I'm blind as a bat. And I just thought, oh, thank God. Because I just didn't want to see her because in a way not seeing her made me feel like she can't see me because I was trying so hard not to show on my face how upset and how angry I was. The way I viewed it was I felt like I'd been an experiment for her. It was really strange because she was trying to be so nice. It was like a gentle rejection. It was like a, you know, that was really great. It's like, it's not you, it's me kind of rejection. It was very much like that. And then she told me a bit of a story about some male friend of hers who was like her really, really best male friend, like her soulmate. And the basic nub of the story was that she clearly really fancied this guy and really would have loved a relationship with him, but that he was probably gay. And she was talking about people sort of sleeping with people almost like to try things out or almost to try to get out a feeling that they don't want. You know, that was the inference I was getting. Anyway, off I went. But because I'd popped out my contact lens when I'd got into the bed the night before, couldn't find my contact lens. My clothes were like in this mess because I'd literally just kind of got undressed sitting next to her bed, yeah. And, you know, crept into the bed with her, so my clothes were all there. My room was just around the corner. So she found this dressing gown for me, and I put this little, you know, knee-length silky green dressing gown on, and I had all my clothes all over my arms, all chaotic. I must have looked like the wreck of the Hesperus, you know, mosaic eyeballs, you know, beer breath, and a mug of coffee, you know, precariously in the other hand, and my keys, and I'm sort of, you know, struggling my way back round to my room like this. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then as I got to my room, because she'd looked out to make sure nobody was around, you'd just see me leaving her room, and nobody was. But as I got around the corner and into the corridor where my room was, one of the girls just a few doors down from me was walking past, and she gave me this look. Ooh, you're coming back from someone's room, aren't you? You know, it was just so bloody obvious. And I'm sort of like, oh, hello, like this to this other person's captain. And she, you know, she's eyebrows raised. Oh, morning. He's sort of like that. Oh, morning. Kind of get into my room, you know, like this. But reason I mention that story is because her dressing gown and my dressing gown became prime witnesses in a story. And a dressing gown that had been given to me by my nine donkey's years before ended up in a plastic bag with a tagged exhibit number, as I had to try to prove that I had not assaulted that woman.
That's an important part, because weeks down the line, what happened next from what I remember is you are literally just going about your daily business. You're on the ward or somewhere, and a matron calls you in.
Well, there'd been one other incident.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. And I say this in the book, all that was happening was we were just young people living life and having fun. And, you know, I was certainly not unique or alone in what was happening. But at the same time, what happened to me on those two occasions for me personally, on the journey to sort of accepting who I am, was massively significant to me. And yet obviously wasn't so much to them, because these two women were ostensibly straight. The second one that happened before I got called into matron, that I didn't sleep with her. We did just end up kissing. But in many ways for me, it was more erotic, because there was a strange build up and a flirtation. And also there was conversation had been had in the mess bar before I'd ended up having a drink in her room with her. And it was really interesting, because at that point, it was almost like methinks the lady doth protest too much, because what happened was somebody who'd been posted in from Aldershot, who was equivalent to in the army, they were called ward stewardesses. They're like healthcare assistants, mm-hmm. you know, not a carer, but not a trained nurse. And she knew me, and she knew the rumours about me, and she was giving it a bit of yap, 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 and being a bit bitchy and gossiping about me. And my best friend in the mess was telling me this. And then this other person, who I've called Mags in the book, she was in the bar with myself and Gail, my friend, and we were talking about it. And Gail was telling me that this other officer had been bitching about me and saying, oh, this ward stewardess says, Elaine, you know, she might be gay, might be this, might be that. And Gail was like, oh, don't be ridiculous. You know, although Gail knew how I felt and that I probably was, but, you know, she was a brilliant friend.
She was defending you by the sounds of it. She was actually...
Yeah, she was. And she was, oh, don't be ridiculous, you know. And I was still seeing men and being set up with different men, you know, and going on dates and kind of covering my tracks. And I'd been seen snogging that guy. So, you know, my straight credentials were intact. My beard, you know, was working. It's so ridiculous. You look back, you can't believe you're talking about yourself. It's almost like an out-of-body experience. But anyway, this Mags was very much... Well, even if you were, it wouldn't matter. It's nobody's bloody business. I don't know why people are so bothered. She was really off on a rant about, you know, sexuality and freedom and everything else. And then we got talking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And obviously we then got talking about, you know, the freedom of sexuality in that storyline, and how outrageous it was when it first came out in the mid-70s. And then we were talking about the different songs in it. And then, of course, we're talking about the amazing, you know, wonderful refrain at the very end. You don't dream it, be it. Just live your own best life. Do what makes you happy, as long as you're hurting no one else, you know. So we were nattering away over a few groshes, you know, that about that ethos. And that was that. Before she'd gone off up to bed, I remember her saying to me, because I'd bought a six pack of grosh on my bar tab to take up to my room. And she said, oh, if my light's on when you go by, bring in a grosh. And I said, don't say that because I will. And she said, yeah, you do that. And off she went. So, of course, I did. And so, of course, when I went in, what did she have on her record player? Rocky Horror Picture Show soundtrack.
And the lure is set.
I know. And she... She said, come on in and everything. She said, and again, she was in her bed, in her single bed. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, look, I'll go to bed. I mean, it was, yeah, Groundhog Day. And no, come on in. Have you got a grosh? Yeah, I'll have another one. So I opened her a grosh, She's playing the record, we're talking. And then there was just this tension. It was just there, and, you know, it built. And because we've been talking about sex and sexuality and freedom to express yourself and everything else, and we're just looking at each other, and you take a sip of your beer and another look. And it was just, this tension was unbearable. And then on came, you know, that song, and we were both singing along. Don't dream it, be it. Swig of beer, nervous laugh, look at each other, sing a bit more, another swig of beer, nervous laugh, look at each other. And we ended up kissing, and it was so natural. And it was not either of us initiated it, you know, that is my truth to my dying day. We just fell into an embrace, literally. Yeah. And it was very erotic. And it again, a big surprise to me, but a very pleasant surprise. And I was more attracted to her than I had been, you know, Mel wasn't really attracted to Mel, but there was something about Mags I found quite attractive as well. So it was a different scenario for me. And then sure enough, just as things seemed to be, you know, hotting up and everything, she pulls away and says, oh, it's just moving a bit too fast for me. I'm sorry. I've never done anything like this before. And I thought, oh, Christ, here we go again. And I was, okay. And I immediately, you know, it's like instant, okay, I'm out of here. I'll go. Sorry. And off I went. Didn't think any more of it. A couple of nights later, a big bunch of us again out in the town, you know, in bars and standing with each other. She kept coming really close to me. She kept putting her thigh against my thigh. She'd keep leaning right across me to get her drinks. And I just thought, what are you doing? You know, if you're not interested, you don't, that's fine, but don't give out mixed messages. Yeah, I couldn't understand what was going on. So that was that. But it was, oh, no, don't worry. You know, we're all still great friends. And she was trying to set me up with some male doctor friend of hers. And I just thought, I just don't know what is going on. This is too freaky. And didn't think any more of it. And then it was, again, many weeks after that second incident, and so a few months after the first incident, when I was called to see Matron. She rang the office. I was working on the off duties in the ward office, and, Lieutenant Chambers, yes, it's Matron here. I need you to come to my office immediately. And so I said, that will leave the ward without any RGN cover, ma'am, because, you know, you're always meant to have one trained staff nurse, which is an RGN, registered general nurse. I was the only one on duty. It doesn't matter. Come to my office immediately. Yes, ma'am. Put the phone down. And I couldn't believe it. And so I went in, sit down, face like thunder, furious. And she'd made up her mind about me before I'd even said a single word. It was amazing. And she just basically said, do you know why you're here? And I said, no, ma'am. And she said, well, she said, it's come to my attention that you have made passes of an unwanted nature to two of your fellow officers. What have you got to say for yourself? And I blushed beetroot. I knew I hadn't made passes at anybody, but I equally knew that there had been these brief involvements, obviously, with two fellow officers. So I'm like thinking, okay, what the hell is going on? But I didn't have any problem with saying, well, it's not true, because it wasn't. You know, I hadn't made a pass. You know, what had happened was utterly mutually consensual. In the first case, I'd been invited in. So I said, could you tell me who's making these accusations? No. So I thought, okay, this is a bit weird. So you're saying this is not true? I said, this is not true. She said, right. As you're denying this, how did she word it? As you're denying this, I'll have to take advice. So you're dismissed. I will speak to you later. Or I went back to the ward and, oh my God, you know, you can imagine my brain was just like, oh my God, Jesus Christ. And so I was on this split shift. So not long after I go off, I've got 4 hours away before I have to come back again to do 3 hours into the evening. And so I ran back to the mess and I started putting anything that I thought would paint me with a sapphic taint of a brush.
You degayed your quarters.
I did. Or I attempted to. And, you know, it was just one room. But I managed to fill 2 carrier bags, you know, books, photographs, just anything I was a bit concerned about, some letters, including diaries going back to my early teens. And I put them in these bags and I was like, oh God, where am I going to put these bags? I don't know where to put them. I didn't want to destroy them. And I couldn't have destroyed them anyway. I mean, there's nowhere I could have set fire to them without drawing attention to myself. There was no shredding machines or anything. I thought I could have gone and hidden them in the loft, but it would have been very obvious in the middle of the afternoon. So I thought that's no good. My best mate, Gail, was out seeing her German boyfriend in town. And my other friend in the ranks was on holiday, so I couldn't even sneak up to the billets over the hospital. So there was nothing I could do. And I thought, well, it's Friday afternoon, and there's an acronym they use a lot in the military, and they call it Poets' Day. And they say Friday is Poets' Day, and that means piss off early, tomorrow's Saturday. And a lot of people used to sneak off early because it's the weekend. So I thought, in my naivety, you know, nobody's going to come now. They'll come on Monday. And so I went back to work. I'd been back about 15, 20 minutes. Phone rings. Lieutenant Chambers, Colonel here, come to my office immediately. And I said again, I said, that'll leave the ward with no RGN cover, ma'am. I'm just going to get away with it, you know.
Go, try it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll try and please, you know, these poor patients, they need me. My patients need me. Please, ma'am, don't bring me over to your office now. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Get over here now. Yes, ma'am. Phone down. Go and tell her, I'm really sorry. I've got to go and see Matron again. And I'm like, bloody hell, what's the matter? I was like, oh, I don't know anyway. So off I go. Went into the office, and this time she had the military police with her. And they start reading to me from this printed notice to suspect. And I was like, fuck. Oh, my God. What the hell is going on? And then it was accelerated up to allegations. It was never a charge. I was never charged, but it was allegations have been made, and it basically amounted to indecent assault on a female. And, you know, what have you got to say? And I just couldn't believe it. I have assaulted no one. You know, I wouldn't do that. That is, no, it's absolutely not true. Then I was told a little bit more about who it was. And of course, it was the 2 people I'd been briefly involved with. And so I was just like, A, thinking, oh my fucking God, this, what the hell is happening? It's not true. Why are they doing this to me? We've just been out 2 days ago. We're all acting like nothing happened. We're all still friends. Why would they do this to me? Do they hate me that much? You know, God, I just didn't know what was going on. I really couldn't understand it.
It's incomprehensible for most of us probably to face this idea of being called a suspect. Like, you were called a suspect for essentially your sexuality. But beyond that, also there was this allegation around assault, which I assume this is the tricky part, because we're also maybe getting to know internalized homophobia there a little bit. I think.
Completely. Yeah. It was it's complicated on so many levels, because the other important thing to remember was at the time the ban on and they just called it, they called everything that was non-heteronormative homosexuality. So it wouldn't matter what. In those days, homosexuality itself in the military was deemed a criminal offence. That is why you were a suspect, because your homosexuality itself, whether you'd acted on it or done anything, you know, say I had assaulted them, you know, that wouldn't have been the prime issue is that I'm a homosexual. And therefore, I am a criminal by virtue of my sexuality. My orientation is a crime. My existence is a crime.
Horrible.
The existence into which I was born, over which I have absolutely no choice and no control. So, you know, I was basically then told, he said, right, because you're denying the allegations, I need to come and search your room. And I'm like thinking, ooh, 2 carrier bags of evidence sitting on my bed waiting to be poured over. Come and see the evidence that I'm a great big raving pervy puffy leser. Come and see it, mate. Oh my Lord. So even in my head at the time, even though I was terrified, I was kind of amused as well. And I was like, oh my Jesus Christ, what am I going to do? And I remember I was clutching at straws. I remember I say to him, it's quite funny, at the time when I did my basic training as a private, and then 4.5 years later as a lieutenant, I was always the fastest runner. I ran the fastest basic fitness test each time, and I was only a few seconds slower 4.5 years later. So I was a very good sprinter. And I remember thinking, I wonder if I could sprint there before him and like throw them out of the window or something. And then I thought, no, that's not going to work. And then I said, Oh, I said, oh, my room's a dreadful mess. You know, that doesn't matter. You know, we need to come and see your room. And I said, oh, right. And then I thought of another thing. And I said, my handbag is in the office, because we all had military issue handbags. Very, very, very Mrs. Thatcher-esque, very femmy, girly handbags we had
handbag
to use.
Handbag lesbians.
Yeah, handbag lesbians, when we were in uniform, you know, very girly. So I said to him, oh, my room keys are in my handbag in the office. Shall I just go and get it? We'll come with you. Oh, shit. So they march into the bloody ward with me. So, of course, all the staff have seen me come in with a red cap. They're called red caps because they have a red cap. So they all know. So I'm not only being called to matron, but I'm now being accompanied by the military police. So everyone's like, oh, it was appalling. I mean, I make a joke about it because I, you know, that's often my way of dealing with stuff, is to make a laugh and a joke about things. But it was awful. I mean, everyone knew something was afoot, even though they didn't know quite what. I found out later that it was talk that I had stolen controlled drugs, that I had been given illicit sort of, you know, joints of beef from the mess manager, you know, and selling them on, or I was having
a meat smuggler.
Oh my God.
That sounds like blame the lesbian.
That sounds like a euphemism, doesn't it? Oh, she's a rampant meat smuggler, the dirty whore. And then what was the other one? There was another one that I'd been having an affair with a married male officer. Numerous ridiculous rumours flying, none of them anywhere near the mark. Anyway, so we go off to my room, and it took them 3 hours to search it.
Even though you had already lined it up in plastic bags.
Yeah, but you know what though, Jess? Because as we're walking over there, and you've got to imagine, you know, your brain, you know, my head was all over the place. But as we got there, it crossed my mind. You know, I did think to myself that I could have made it a lot quicker and easier. And I could have just said to him, take those two bags. Everything you want is there. But I was also kind of buying myself a tiny bit of thinking time by just sitting there and watching to see what they were doing. But also, in a weird way, I was kind of curious to see what were they going to do? You know, what were they looking for? You know, what did they expect they were going to find? It was quite fascinating in a very weird, disjointed way, as if I was kind of looking down on the whole thing from above, you know, kind of one step removed. So there's this warrant officer, class one, and I think she was a sergeant, and she looked really uncomfortable, and I think she was of the faith, I'm sure of it, and that must have been mortally embarrassing for her, because I just got this feeling, I was getting this vibe, you know, and she looked deeply uncomfortable, and I don't think it was because she thought...
You're saying your gaydar was hitting?
Yeah, I think so. Seriously, I do. I think, how can I prove it? I don't know, but I got that feeling.
I think that there's something about gaydar.
Yeah, I think there is. I think there is, generally. And then, of course, bloody matron. Oh, my God. And she sat there, you know, with this look of utter disdain and disgust on her face, as if she had the most foul stench under her nose. And she had made up her mind about me. I mean, I really was, you know, guilty until proven innocent in her eyes. She just hated me. You could see it. She was just full of loathing. It was excruciatingly painful because my room was quite a mess. It wasn't too bad, but it was quite messy. And they went through literally everything. All of my books. They opened every book out of the shelf, and I had a lot of books. I love reading, looking for letters and things. I had a huge tin because I always had cameras and always took loads of photographs all the time. They took every packet of every photos and looked through every single one, and every now and then they'd say, who's this? Who's this? And I'd be saying, well, that's so-and-so, that's so-and-so. Like, the kind of thing. And your point is, you know, we were just like standing having a photo taken. There's nothing going on, really weird. He looked through every pocket in all of my clothes. He even took all my clothes out of my dirty linen bin, literally. In those days, everything was records, you know, it was vinyl, no CDs yet. Well, there were CDs yet, but
we're going back there.
We are. I know. Yeah, we're coming back full circle. But yeah, he even took every record out of the sleeves, and I had loads. And then he kind of came to the bags, by which point I was really very tempted to say, yeah, see, you've wasted your time. They were there all along. but, you know, he started emptying these bags out. And that was then when it got very painful, because he bagged up a lot of stuff, you know, letters mainly, and all my diaries going back to when I was a young girl at school. And he tagged them and gave them a number, an exhibit number, and he took them away. And knowing that person was going to be the first person other than me to lay eyes on my most intimate thoughts and painful yearnings and confusions as a hormonal little teen was just horrific. And yeah, you know, so that took 3 hours, and he took all this stuff away, all bagged up, and told me I'll be back to carry out the questioning, the investigation on Monday. So this was Friday evening, bear in mind. And off they went, matron, him and the sergeant. And I just burst into tears. I was left alone. That was it. I was just left alone. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if I could go to jail. I assumed I was going to be sacked if I was found guilty. And I thought, there's two people accusing me. It's my word against theirs. How can they prove it? How can I prove it? How can we disprove it? What's going to happen? It actually was genuinely terrifying. And it was such a filthy and disgusting thing of which to be accused, you know, because, you know, assaulting somebody, indecently assaulting somebody, forcing your attentions on them. Jesus, it was terrifying.
But it's heartbreaking to listen to that, because if there ever was a story that really shows how a person can be shamed, that would be it. I mean, yeah. The level of scrutiny you've just described is heartbreaking and terrifying to listen to, because it just illustrates how lucky we are to live in the times we live in right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the cornerstones of the ban, and why they said for such a long time we don't want any, particularly LGB and to a lesser extent T, but it was mainly LGB personnel serving. They used to come out with a couple of really favourite quotes, and one was that it would affect, you know, unit cohesion. And the other they used to trot out was that, you know, because of the risk of blackmail. And we always said, well, yeah, no shit, Sherlock. If we were allowed to be gay, then you couldn't blackmail us. Risk removed, duh.
But that's an interesting argument. It's such a non-argument. I've heard that from my mother. It follows the same footsteps, which is, oh, please, why do you need to choose to be gay? Or what? Don't live a gay lifestyle. People have it so difficult. They get bullied. And I'm like, what, by people like you?
Exactly.
This thing of, we don't want you to be gay because it's horrible out there, because we make it horrible for you. It's just so nonsensical.
It is. It's very strange attitudes, isn't it? It just mystifies me. Again, the key word of choice for me is that you don't have a choice. The only choice you have is whether or not you accept. To me, I'm convinced it's a genetic fate. To me, I'm convinced I was born gay or lesbian or whatever, or preferring women, you know.
Yeah. So to contrast this, we kind of had a bit of a cliffhanger there again. Your room got searched. You are named a suspect.
Yes. Oh, God.
And you didn't end up getting charged for it, but it did it did change everything in your life, in the sense that it cost you your career. So what happened there?
So the investigation was ridiculous. It took a very long time. He came back on the Monday. When I eventually got all my paperwork back 10 years later, after battling for a very long time, they'd put different times on it. They actually questioned me the first time for 15 hours.
Oh, my goodness. Did you get food and water and breaks?
Yeah. I did. And the second time was for 9 hours. Part of the reason it took so long was because, although it's the 1980s and, yeah, compact discs had just been invented and there were Walkmans and all of that sort of thing, they didn't record the interview. So he would ask me a question, I would start answering it, and say, just a moment, because he would then write everything down on a piece of paper with a biro in longhand. It was horrific, because I'm frantically racking my brains to remember key elements, what happened, you know, important things that I think he needs to know to defend myself against these absolutely hateful allegations that were not true. I was fighting for my life, never mind my career, never mind the army, because I thought, God, if I get sent to court martial and if they say I have sexually indecently assaulted somebody, I'll probably get struck off the nursing register. So then I've lost a civilian career. And also, you can be tried twice, because if you get tried in a military court martial, if the people won and they then wanted to sue me in the civil courts, they could do so for the same offence. So I didn't know, because when it first kicked off, I thought, why are they doing this to me? Do they really hate me that much? Oh, my God. If they really do hate me that much, what if they then try me in the civilian courts? I could go to jail. It was terrifying. But he's writing every thing down like this. I mean, it was so, so stressful. It was awful.
It sounds like absolute torture, but did you find out at this point who had instigated this whole mess? Like, what had started this?
Oh, my goodness. It took a long time for me to find out what happened. And some stuff I didn't actually find out until years later. But basically, what had happened was, here's the delicious irony. It's so stupid. As I said, you know, what had happened weeks before, privacy of behind locked doors, nobody's business, nobody knew, and nobody was harmed by it, you know. But the madness was that I effectively ended up being shopped, if you like, by another lesbian. And what happened was, this is where it's very complicated. And part of the reason I wrote the book was because over years and years and years, people used to say to me, "What happened? Were you caught in flagrante delicto?" And I thought, no, I wasn't. To try to explain it was quite difficult because it was complex. But basically, Mags worked on the same ward as another friend of hers and Mel's. This friend was a very, very, very troubled soul. And she was hitting the booze very heavily at that time in her life because she herself had been very badly sexually abused as a child by her own father. Her father had died. And this woman, young woman, was hitting the drink, not sleeping well, getting increasingly mentally disturbed because she was having dreams and nightmares about her father coming out of the grave to come back. So, Mags and Mel had been taking it in turns to sleep on this other woman's floor, and they were just really worried about her. And back in those days, it was very difficult. If you were ill in the military, you couldn't just ring in sick, you know, like in Civvy Street, you can't ring in sick. You have to go to what's called sick parade. So you have to drag yourself out of your bed, go and present yourself to the medical officer and be examined sort of in the hospital, and then they decide what to do with you. There was a lot of stigma in those days about sort of mental health. So people basically would try everything they could to keep away from having to go and see the medical officer about anything. So basically, Mags and Mel were trying to get this poor woman through this crisis around this anniversary, you know, of her father's death. So their boss, Mags and this woman's boss, who was a major, everybody knew that this woman was a lesbian. Nobody cared because she was very good at her job. She was liked. She was funny. She was quite witty. People liked her. She would do everything she could to try to present as if she were straight. And she would say things like, in a not so subtle sotto voce way, young male subaltern would wander in, you know, to the lunch room, and we'd all be sitting finishing our lunch at the table in the officer's mess, all very nice. And she'd sort of go, "Oh, wash that boy and send him to my room." And we'd all be thinking, "Yeah, right. You know, we all knew. Why would we send this boy to your room? You don't, you know, you're really not interested in that boy. Don't pretend you are." You know, we all know. And it was embarrassing, actually. It was uncomfortable because we all knew she was gay. She probably knew that we knew. And it was just this pathetic act. And it was embarrassing, actually. But we'd all sort of politely laugh because she was a major and we were lieutenants and captains. And we were like,
ah. Poor boy being objectified as well, just saying, there's not much.
Exactly. Anyway. It's true. Yeah, very, very poor behaviour. But so this particular time, Mags and Mel had always been a bit concerned that maybe this major was attracted to this woman, this very troubled woman who was one of her members of staff. And she was a very attractive woman. And one day the major is saying to them, "Do you think that all of this dreadful stuff that's happened," because she knew a bit about what had gone on with this poor woman, "means she might end up with lesbian tendencies?" And Mags, and I don't think she meant it to drop me in it, I really don't. I think she wanted to put the major off being attracted to this poor troubled woman, because that's the last thing she needs, you know, is anything like that going on. So she just stupidly said something off the back of, you know, like that. And she said, "Oh, no, if anyone in the mess has lesbian tendencies, then it's Elaine." And that was it. Yeah, that was it. Seriously, that was it. Just saying that sentence, that set the ball in motion. Seriously, if she hadn't have said that to that woman at that time, I don't think the investigation would ever have happened. We'd have all just trundled on as we did. ignoring what had happened, still being friends and socializing. You know, Mag's sometimes still being a flirt and a tease, but not really having the guts to go through with it. So fine, go off, doesn't matter. But because she said it to that person, she then absolutely, it was like a terrier with a rag. She took a hold and would not let go. So she kept saying to Mags, well, hang on a minute. What do you mean? Why are you saying that? You know, you do realize that's not allowed, don't you? And then she can't turn around and say, well, because we ended up snugging each other's faces off to Don't Dream It, Be It, you know, after a few groshes in the bar. Aren't we shocking? Because if she does that, she's then saying she has lesbian tendencies, or that even if she doesn't have lesbian tendencies, to even act upon it in even a moment's aberration, in quotation marks, is going to put you down as somebody who has committed a criminal act whilst serving in the military, which is not tolerated because it's illegal in the military. Gosh. So she cannot say how she knows, because she is then
incriminating, you know, herself.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. So she, I think, panicked. I never fully understood how it was that Mel came up admitting that, you know, she was this other person who'd been involved, but she did. And that was heartbreaking, because, well, she had a complete nervous breakdown, because initially she lied as well. It was quite interesting because she shot herself in the foot, actually, bless her, by making up this story, because what she said had happened, this is how the dressing gowns come in. She told them that what had happened was, one evening I had been upset about something and I'd come into her room and she'd sat next to me on the bed and was comforting me because I was upset about something and crying, and she put an arm around me and I'd leapt round and grabbed her, you know, kind of lunged at her and touched her breast and lunged at her, and that she'd pushed me off and sent me away, you know, with my tail between my legs telling me, go away, what do you think you're doing, you fool, sort of thing, that kind of thing. So basically, when you're questioned for those 15 hours, I was asked about this night and that night, what happened. At that point, I'd taken military legal advice, which was rubbish, but basically the military legal advice, although it was rubbish, was true, because it was illegal in those days in the army. I knew my career was over. They'd got my diaries, they'd got my letters, so they knew I had tendencies, if nothing else. So I knew I was finished. That was it. My career was over immediately. So my key objective was to make sure I was not charged with those offences, because I had not committed those offences. And that was my key aim. So because I knew that they knew I had lesbian tendencies, or I had been involved with women, I just told them the utter truth. Everything that happened, you know, I'd snogged this guy, I went here, she invited me there, she said this, I got into bed, I gave him all the details. He then was asking for even more details. Does she have any birthmarks? Did you notice this? No, we were in bed in the dark.
How intrusive is that?
Oh, it was disgusting. He wanted to know everything I'd done to her, she'd done to me, who did what first, did you use your fingers, did you do this, did you have oral sex, did you use any toys, you name it. It was disgusting. But because I knew I hadn't assaulted anyone, and I was terrified I might get, you know, taken to court and convicted of something I hadn't done, I told them everything, because I knew I was not ashamed. You know, we were two adults. It was mutually consensual. We'd hurt no one else. It was nobody's bloody business what we'd done in bed that night. Nobody's. You know, we were not on duty. I knew we'd done nothing wrong in the eyes of the wider world and society. Yeah. And it was not a good enough reason for me to be sacked. Because I also knew, had I been found to have slept with a man, I would not have been sacked. I would have had a wrist slap, probably been told, you know, behave more like an officer, or, you know, don't do things on the premises or whatever. But I wouldn't have lost my career had it been a man. That's 100% factual. So, you know, but basically what happened was, because she'd said that I'd lunged at her and then been sent away, and I was able to say, no, I stayed the night, I left in the morning wearing her dressing gown. And he was immediately, oh, can you remember what her dressing gown looked like? Except it was, you know, let's write down, can you remember what the, oh, God's sake. Yes, it was pale jade green, silky, looked Japanese. Wait a moment. Yes, it was pale jade. Oh, it was awful. And eventually her boxes were all packed because she was due to go back. She was due to be posted out for her course. It's heartbreaking. Her boxes had to be opened up in the hallway. They went through all her boxes until they found this dressing gown. And then he said to me, is this the dressing gown? I said, yes. And then he said, and you said you normally wear a completely different dress. I said, yes, I do. I wear a very old fashioned, down to the floor, blue candle wick number that my grandmother gave me. It's very warm and very old fashioned and very ugly. Would you like to say, yes, I would. So we go to my room and he said, so people would normally associate you with this blue, woolly, stripy lined candle wick dressing gown. I said, yes. Thank you. Can I have that, ma'am? Bags it up, tags it. Bags up her dressing gown, then finds, he said, did anyone see you wearing the pale green knee length number? And I remembered the captain that I'd seen. Oh, morning. And I said, yes, Captain such a person from room number such a person. So she was called in and questioned and statements taken on the morning of such and such a thing. Do you remember seeing Lieutenant Chambers? Yes. And that was amazing because then that rebutted, it kind of saved me in a nutty way, because they then went back to Mel and questioned her for a second time and said, you know, your version of events is very different to Lieutenant Chambers' version of events. And eventually she confessed that she'd lied and that my version of events was in fact completely true. And thank God that she did, because that's what prevented, you know, me from being charged. But she then, absolutely, it was horrendous. She had complete nervous breakdown, and it was a true breakdown. It was horrendous.
She was charged, wasn't she, in the end?
Yes. She wasn't charged, but what happened? No,
perverting the course of justice or something was in the air.
Yeah, it's something like that. It's I can't remember exactly what the wording was, but basically what happened was, this just breaks my heart, because as I said, for basically a few hours of not particularly brilliant sex, you know, that was nobody's bloody business, she lost everything. You know, as I say, she was a captain. She was about to go on a course that she'd wanted to do for a very long time. She probably was straight. I don't know. But it doesn't matter whether she, it doesn't matter what she was. The point is, what had happened between us was, between us, it was nobody's bloody business. It did not affect how we nursed, you know, or how we would nurse in a war zone or anything else. It's completely irrelevant to our ability to follow that career. So what happened was, she had the breakdown. So then she was flown back to the UK, to the psychiatric unit of one of the military hospitals there. Eventually, after being treated, she was discharged. She was just thrown out. And she was basically...
She was treated in a psychiatric unit because of the breakdown?
Because of the breakdown.
Because of other
stuff. Because of the breakdown.
Okay, good.
Although, incidentally and interestingly, while the investigation was on, I had to go and see a psychiatrist in the hospital, because it used to be viewed in those days as if it was some sort of illness. I was assessed by a wonderful major who was actually lovely, and who off the record thought it was the biggest crock of shite, frankly. But he was very kind. He wrote a very, very nice letter for me to take and give to my GP if I decided in the future, when things settled down a little bit, when I was back in a civilian again, whether I might want to go and seek what they then called psychosexual counselling, which I did. But that's another quite amusing story. But yeah, you know, it was heartbreaking. So she was eventually made to resign her commission, because they said that she had acted in a way that was, you know, unbefitting an officer, basically because of lying.
I'm sort of struck by your compassion for her, and I find myself having compassion for all of the people involved. But the thing that is kind of sticking with me is how people who are probably of the same tendencies, as we call it here, kind of snitch each other out, and there's a lot of backstabbing, and I'm still stuck on the major. I'm kind of thinking, gosh, how weird.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, here's a fascinating thing about the major. And it's very interesting, because I think in the military, there's a similar thing. I remember after I left the military and started properly coming out to myself and coming out on the scene in London, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, which was wonderful. It was interesting. You know, there's always this talk about how incestuous it is. You know, everybody's slept with everybody, slept with everyone exes, and everyone knows each other, and da 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 da. So this major, when I was eventually sent back to the UK, I had to go and do a couple of official things before I was properly, you know, signed off. One was to go to the QA training centre. That's where you know, go for a final medical, and you'd have to re-sign the Official Secrets Act and all that sort of thing. And I saw the commandant of the training centre, who was the only high-ranking officer who was actually very nice to me. She was very kind, and that really meant a lot. And then the last thing I had to do was I had to go and see our highest ranking officer, and her office is based in Holborn. Funnily enough, just down the road from the hotel that I started my first job. So I go to her office So bearing in mind that during the investigation, when they got away from the idea that I had assaulted people and realised they weren't going to be able to hang that charge on me because I hadn't, and because Mel had confessed that I hadn't, Max always maintained that I had made a move on her. So that was never proved or disproved either way, but Mel was key, you know. Then on the second lot of questions, he's trying really hard to get other names from me. But when I went and saw the Brigadier, I couldn't believe it. So I go to wait outside her very grand office. And there's various little offices around. One of the people there was at that point a major, and she had a very important role at the time. And she was all to do with plannings and postings. Now, you can imagine certain postings are very appealing, very appealing. Yeah. Now, the major back in Hanover often used to allude to her people on her ward and her specialism. Oh, you know, I might be able to help if you, you know, she used to allude to postings and she might be able to have a bit of an influence, you know, and maybe help you if you wanted a certain posting, because certain postings at that time were viewed as very plumb, like Hong Kong, Nepal, places like that. And that was because her partner was the major outside the Brigadier's office. And in another very interesting twist of fate, my lovely friend that I told you about, who was my nurse tutor, who taught me how to nurse and who became a friend after I left the army, She knew these two people. So she knew they were a couple because they were friends of hers. And she was able to confirm to me that they were a couple. And the major at the Brigadier's office eventually went on to become one of the highest ranking positions in the QAs. And another irony, just a couple of years ago, another of the student officers on the same course as me when I became commissioned and got became a lieutenant, she had been to that woman's retirement do and this fellow student officer was saying to me, Elaine, isn't it fantastic? All the work that you did means that she was able to be there with her partner when she retired. It wasn't the same woman. It was a different one by then. But the point being, they're saying, hey, the highest ranking QA person can sit there with their same sex partner because of all the work you did. And I'm thinking, yeah, and she was outside the office when the Brigadier is telling me I'm a complete disgrace to the army and to the Corps. And I looked her back in the eye and I said, I think the Corps has let me down. And she said, I'd let the Corps down. So it's the incestuous nature, the hypocrisy and everybody knowing everybody. And, you know, and I said to this student, you know, that is a compliment, but very painful at the same time. Yes, it's great that they can do that, but I would have liked to have been able to do that.
It's heartbreaking. And it is really infuriating just to hear that, because in many ways, you're like a person that had to go through this hardship and a lot of injustice and paved the way for people. So let's go there. You left and you said it came at a price for Mel, but it also came at a huge price for you, and it wasn't just done with you leaving. What price did it come at for you, and what was the work that you did afterwards?
The biggest price I paid for many years was a real double-edged sword, because eventually I came back home. And I, you know, had to come out to mum and dad. Didn't hear from them for ages, which was awful, because it all happened around the same time that my nine had died. And it was a terrible, terrible time. Anyway, they were fine and they accepted me and I went home. And obviously, being a nurse and an army trained nurse, I could get work with no difficulty. So I did agency nursing for a very long time. I started coming out. I finally plucked up courage and, you know, went to Gaze the Word and then went to a coming out topic, you know, discussion. And everyone was like, what? You know, most people didn't even know this still happened or even happened at all in the army. And so I was having a wonderful time. You know, I was meeting all these women who were utterly free and happy to be themselves, of all shapes, sizes, butch, femme, young, old. It was wonderful, absolutely exhilarating. Of course, then as well, the scene was fabulous, because you had the LLGC, you had the women's disco on the Saturday, and, you know, you had the tea dance on the Sunday, and there was just stuff going on. At the very same time, I was so, so, so racked with insecurity, because if I ever felt I was attracted to somebody, or maybe it was mutual, and or maybe I felt someone was flirting with me, I was terrified to make a move.
Yeah.
Because even though I knew I hadn't assaulted anyone, I'd done nothing wrong, even being accused of that even just the association with that thought, I was terrified, because I thought, my God, you know, if I show someone I'm interested in, or I want to try and flirt with them, what if they think I'm pushing too hard or too far or whatever? You know, I did get over it, and, you know, but it took a long time. I was very insecure and uncomfortable. I ended up sort of being the reluctant activist, because I didn't mean to be an activist, but it was fate. You know, fate leads you places. We'd gone to the LLGC, and someone spotted an article in the pink paper and said, hey, you should read this. It'll be of interest to you. And I read it on the train on the way home, and I got in very late, and I rang the guy up, because the article was by, it was about a guy called Robert Ely, who had served for nearly 20 years from the age of 17. He'd only known the army, a boy soldier, had lost absolutely everything because of a letter that was found that he'd written to a soldier in Germany. He had to sell his house, give up his dog, he's lost his pension, everything. He was getting involved with Stonewall, which had only come into existence about a year before. And they were looking for people to speak up at the Armed Forces Select Committee, which meets in the House of Parliament every 5 years to determine forces policies, any changes that need to be made. And Robert ended up giving testimony. Yeah. So there was an interest in it, and Stonewall were looking for a first big fight to fight, you know, to sort of, they were founded on the back of obviously Section 28 and stuff like that. But also they wanted a case to kind of hang their hat on, so to speak. And the gaze in the military was a very good one for them. So I rang him up when I got in, and he did answer. You know, it was just incredible. We probably spoke that first time for 2 to 3 hours, because neither of us knew of anybody else who'd gone through that. And it was just such a cathartic release to speak to somebody who understood, who's from the military. And we talked and talked and talked. And we met up. He came and stayed with me in Beckenham. And then we were invited to take part in a documentary. And it was The Heart of the Matter with Joan Bakewell. And that went out in June 91. And that was massively helpful to us, because they wheeled out some utter old fart idiots from the why we need to keep the ban side, you know, trotting out the same old tired arguments. And our side came over very calmly and rationally, and it was fantastic. And at the same time as all of that was going on, and Robert was gathering information and evidence, we decided we needed to do something. So we set up our organization, and we called it Rank Outsiders. It gradually, I think at its peak, we had about 3,000 members. Wow. Which, yeah, you know, considering it, that's pre-internet. So this is all on, you know, just handwriting our own little flyers and printing them off and taking them around to pubs and clubs, or and going on TV. You know, at the time there were quite a few programs. You know, there was the Out and Out on Tuesday, and Gay Time TV, and, you know, there were various documentaries. We appeared on quite a lot of debate programs, news programs, and then we kind of gradually built up links, and we gradually managed to get sort of gentle inroads with certain MPs that were amenable to what we were trying to do. Initially, the Ministry of Defence just didn't want to know. They'd done that classic thing of people making up their mind about a person or an organisation without knowing a damn thing about what our ethos was. And their immediate thought was we were going to be troublemakers, that we were going to be disrespectful, loud, bolshy, just a pain in the neck. I think they thought we were going to be akin to a lot of the much more action-based groups of the time, like Outrage, like the Lesbian Avengers, like ACT UP.
Even though you probably would have been way more efficient at upselling the Houses of Parliament. That's a different story.
Oh, I'd have loved to have done that. Yeah, I would have loved to have done that. I mean, we did talk about it. You know, we were very structured, which you might expect from ex-military. You know, we had a proper committee, and we had various roles. We ministered our meetings, and we had an objective, and we were very organised. But we had many sort of Mrs. Merton-esque heated debates about, shall we go this sort of ACT UP way? Shall we all learn the Monty Python? Oh, get her camp soldiers doing drill and do that outside the Ministry of Defence. Or shall we go suited and booted formal, the style that they know and understand, that's less threatening and that says, look,
speak the language.
Yes, absolutely. And say, look, you're getting rid of people that you trained to your standards. That's why we're tough adversaries, because you trained us to be this good. So, yeah, it's funny.
It's fascinating. Oh, one of the episodes that aired of this podcast where I was speaking to somebody who only just peripherally had sort of army experience. She was talking about the US side of things and how there was this court case that was based around this notion of, well, can you as the state prove to us that our presence as gay people hinders us from serving effectively or truly causes a disruption? Because that is really difficult to prove, actually, if you really think about it.
Totally. And, you know, and the other side of it that was often very frustrating is whenever we were on these debate programs and, you know, people would be trotted out to argue for keeping the ban. It was quite interesting because one of the things that they often used to say was that the rank and file, so all the lower rank folk, would hate being forced to work without, you know, LGB folk, and it would be dreadful, and they would leave in their droves. You know, it was absolutely untrue because, A, most people that you worked with knew. They either knew that you were closeted or you were open but discreet, or some people just outright, they were there and you knew, and they didn't care. Most people just wanted to know, are you good at your job? When we are under fire, are you going to be an excellent staff nurse or ward sister or, you know, whatever your role is, fighter pilot? Are you going to fly your plane as you're meant to? Of course you are. That's what you're trained to do. Your sexuality, your orientation, whatever you wish to call it, has nothing to do with your ability to carry out a prescribed role.
It's a remarkable story, and I'm feeling so honored to have been able to hear that from you, because reading it is one thing, but hearing it is very special too. And there's plenty of things that you haven't mentioned.
Yes, thank you.
So I'd really encourage people who are listening to this. I know we've talked for a long time, but this is a very juicy and meaty book. If you want to buy it, I'd recommend that you, obviously in non-pandemic times, go to an independent bookshop like Gaze the Word here in London. It's called This Queer Angel. And obviously, Elaine, I'm not going to let you just go like this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I'm going to ask you a question. If you could have a lesbian affair with somebody from past, present or future or fiction,
yes,
history,
oh,
who could it be?
Well, because I've listened to some of your podcasts, I knew this question was coming. And then I thought, well, what do I do? I was thinking, do I go for one really, really serious one? Or do I go for a very banal and shallow four factor one? Right. Real person. Jackie Forster, I used to see on the telly, on those programs in the 80s, you know, like I mentioned, Out on Tuesday, Gay Time TV.
Journalist, lesbian maverick.
Yeah, I found her enormously attractive. I mean, she was attractive. There was the four factor, but it was less that than just, I just thought, wow, you know, she just was intelligent, articulate, fierce.
Very nice voice.
Yeah, absolutely. So she's right up there. And then a fictional character, but played by a real person. There was a dreadful, rickety old series in the 1970s on the BBC called Blake's Seven. I don't know, you might not have heard of it.
I haven't heard of that one, no.
It was very cheesy and very ridiculous, but it was in the 70s. So it was all around the time I'd seen that programme and thought, oh, hello, ooh, women.
Mm. I'm Googling it.
Oh, okay. And there was an actress called Jacqueline Pierce, and she played the villainess of the piece, Servalan. Which sounds a bit like a servalat, you know, and she didn't look at all like a sausage or meat or anything, but she was the villain. Jacqueline Pierce played Servalan.
She's got a real femme fatale look from what I'm seeing here.
Yes, but she had this very, very short black hair, and she was just evil and sexy. And as a hormonal teenager, naive and silly, she was the first kind of sexy femme fatale kind of woman that was on a programme I'd be allowed to watch because it was a silly BBC space programme. And so we'd all be watching it. Oh, isn't Blake a great hero? And yes. And in something, oh, hello, Servalan. You know, she was just very, yes. So that was my first sort of big female-y crush. But my real biggie, I would say, would be the gorgeous Juliette Binoche with her hair really short, because that's another thing we talk about, you know, stereotypes and androgyny, all those sort of things. But when she has her hair cut short in the film The Clouds of Sils Maria, have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it. I think it's with Kristen Stewart, isn't it?
Kristen Stewart. Yes, it was equally. Yeah, hello. But yeah, far too young. But anyway, Juliette, short hair, Clouds of Sils, what's it? Because she's beautiful, she's intelligent, she does art, she dances, she's just
ticks all the boxes.
Stunning. I love Juliette. I think is that enough? One, Carrie Anne Moss as Trinity in the first Matrix.
I agree with that one.
Oh, I'm so shallow. Oh, that's shocking, isn't it?
It's not. We're just human.
No, beings. I should have been all arty and said, you know, Vita Sackville-West or Romaine Brooks or something.
Oh, we've had that plenty of times. I really appreciate the just honesty in this podcast.
Okay. Fair enough.
Brilliant. Oh, Elaine, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's been really nice talking to you. And everybody listen, get Elaine's book. Take care, Elaine.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Thank you. It's been absolutely brilliant.